Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Greetings, ghoul fiends. Welcome to the Extra Credit Compilation Tape from Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. This week, we couldn't settle on any particular movie or topic, so we're just going to cover them all.
All of the movies, all of the topics. We're going to get it all done in this episode. We've got to start somewhere. Since we started the month with The Fly, I guess let's start there. We talked about the 1958 film a lot in that episode, since it was so faithful to the story.
Yeah.
And then I cut it out of the show. But we said, oh, we should watch the other five Fly films and talk about that for extra credit. So I watched the 1986 movie. And even though I enjoyed it, I was pretty sure I couldn't sustain the necessary Fly enthusiasm through another four films. But you've seen the 86 film, right?
Oh, God, yeah. Many times. I was super into it as a teenager because it had cool effects and it was really creepy. I started to watch it again recently, but then I stopped.
Why did you stop?
I just got busy with other stuff and I just didn't go back to it. So it's a Cronenberg film and it has that Cronenberg kind of feel to it, which I've really liked in Scanners, because Scanners is such a weird feeling film.
It really is. Yeah.
It's really low budget and slow, and the acted's kind of stilted in the strange way, but it makes it really interesting for me. And this had a little bit of that, but less so. So I wasn't pulled in as strongly as I was with Scanners.
Scanners, I didn't even see back then, but when I watched recently, I was impressed by how good it was. Mm-hmm. This one on the revisit, I was like, I don't know, man.
Yeah.
First of all, it's very gross.
It's really gross.
Which is kind of what Cronenberg does, so you have to expect that. I think that's the primary value proposition of the film is the special effects and the grossness of it.
Yeah.
But I kept wondering, why would Gina Davis ever be with Jeff Goldblum in this movie? Charming though he is, and he plays a little jazz piano in the beginning of it.
He does.
He picks her up at a party.
Yes.
And she's a journalist, although he doesn't quite understand she's a journalist, which I thought he did know. And he just brings her home shortly thereafter, after she finds out what the experiment is.
He knows that she's a journalist. He just wasn't, he didn't seem like he thought it all through, because when she started recording it, he was like, whoa, you can't be telling people about this. And she's like, yeah, I'm a journalist. Because she says it right at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just hot for her.
He thought that she was really into him. Perhaps it would have been more realistic if then she's like, no, the reason I came home with you, a stranger, is because I wanted to get a story about your teleportation pods. But it does turn out that she's into him.
Yeah.
She basically moves into the loft and starts a new life with him within a week or something like that.
It happens.
I just was wondering, why would she? I didn't question it back then, but I'm going, this doesn't make any sense. And also, why didn't they just have them already know each other? It seems like that would have been a shorthand to more of a relationship. But and then also, okay, so she works for an editor who is a straight up Weinstein. This guy is a complete sexual predator, harasses Gina Davis through the whole movie.
Oh, right.
And guess what? He's the hero. At the end, when Brundle Fly is, he melts his hand off and does all this nasty stuff to him. But he's so I guess he gets some comeuppance, but he's sort of the one who saves the day. So it had a kind of sheen of weird 80s things that don't revisit too well.
Right, yeah.
And I kind of couldn't tell what it was saying. In fact, I thought the 50s one had a clearer theme to it. Mm-hmm. You know, at the end, Brundle Fly wants to absorb the whole family because Gina Davis is pregnant. She has that awful maggot
dream.
But she's got a baby, and he says, let me put you through the teleportation device and we'll all become one creature, which is pretty rad from a Fangoria perspective. You know, I wanted to see it happen, but I didn't really get what that was saying about, well, anything.
He was pretty nuts by that point in the film. So
his
thinking, because he was fly brain, wasn't the straightest of thought processes going on there.
No.
But revisiting 80s thing, I just watched Ghostbusters with my son because I loved Ghostbusters when I was a kid.
Still love it, yeah.
It's great. I still love it. But there are a few bits where Bill Murray is sexually inappropriate.
Yeah.
He's hitting on people in a way that was cute, I guess, in the 80s, but now as an adult.
Downright heroic in the 80s.
It's harassment.
Yeah.
There's signals. Sometimes you could flirt with somebody and they flirt back. But in her apartment scene, Dana Barrett and Peter Venkman, she's not giving those signals back at all. She's just kind of like, get out of my apartment. I've had enough. And he leaves, fair enough, when she said, but slowly. He really takes his time when he leaves.
Bill Murray is so damn charming.
He is.
That he starts out that movie shocking that poor nerd in his fake psychological experiment so that he can hook up with, is it?
A college student.
A college student who he's into. And normally that would put me against this person, but I still am like, ah, look at him go. Crazy Peter Venkman. And yet, even with all of that, I do remember going, why is Sigourney Weaver like him?
Oh, yeah.
I do remember being a kid and being surprised that she was sort of in love with him at the end, or at least thinking, well, they went through a scary experience together, so
yeah,
that's kind of hot. And then it'll trickle off and she'll go back to that guy with the scarf from the symphony.
And then she does in the second movie. Remember, she had a baby with some other dude.
Oh, that's right.
And she runs into Peter Venkman again. So that's, their relationship did not last.
Is it a fly baby that she has? Am I remembering?
It's not a fly baby. That's Gina Davis.
Because, you know, the sequel to the Jeff Goldblum movie, Eric Stoltz is the fly baby.
Eric Stoltz is the fly baby. That's correct. Yes.
My memory of The Fly 2 is that it's really gory. Isn't there like a dog that gets turned inside out or something like that?
Hmm.
I just didn't want to watch it. That's when this whole idea of doing nothing but The Fly fell apart, because I went, I think it's good. Like, I remember liking it, but I don't want to really watch something gross. Again, I got my gross quotient. But something that we didn't point out on the episode about the original Fly, I was reading this article on Den of Geek by a fellow named Don Kay called The Enduring Legacy of the Fly, that talks about all the movies. Mm-hmm. And in reference to that first one, he says, yes, the science is wonky as hell. As many have famously pointed out, how does Andre's brain stay inside the fly's head so that he can communicate with his wife via written messages? And if his brain is in the fly's head, how is it also in his own shrunken noggin, as we can ascertain clearly in the film's classic Help Me ending? Why is his human brain in both animals?
My argument would be that part of his brain is in both. So part of his intelligence is in those things. Like in the fly, the little fly body with the human head, there's very little of his intelligence in that thing. But there's more of his intelligence in the... But why his left arm and his head and not the rest of his body? Why wasn't it more...
It's pretty funny in that original movie when he's fighting with his own hand, though. That's like that's proto Evil Dead 2 stuff. It's pretty good. Well, maybe it's actually you zap from one thing to the other, but there is some leftover molecules floating around in the air. And so his brain was slowly transferring from the fly to the small brain in a slow, like a cat stream, like Dandolo, like how there's just he's just out there. Anyway, I remember being frustrated by that as a kid. Return of the Fly.
Return of the Fly. Return of the Fly. With Vincent Price here. Return of the Fly.
That came out in 1959. And as we said in the episode, many of the images we think of when we think of those fly movies come from that one, because it's in black and white and the fly head is much bigger. It's kind of a Young Frankenstein plot, a little like The Fly 2. Vincent Price is in it and he has to deal with his brother's son reproducing the experiment.
Yep.
But at least it says the film's villain is an industrial spy who wants to sell the teleportation secrets. And it's he who rather maliciously ends up throwing Philippe into a disintegration chamber with a fly, purposely. So that's good that it wasn't just he happened to make the same mistake as his father, which would have been bad. Curse of the Fly, I think, is available on YouTube. That's from 1965. It's the third one, shot in England.
No Vincent Price. So you know it's got to be low. If they couldn't afford Vincent Price, come on.
Yeah, this is a low budget movie. I started watching a little bit and went, I don't know if I want to. And they changed continuity very much like House of Frankenstein or something, where they just sort of throw things out. Philippe Delambre has somehow become Henri Delambre. He's successfully achieved teleportation with the help of his own son, Martin. So there's another son.
All right.
But it does sound interesting. It says it opens with a striking nighttime sequence in which an underwear-clad woman escapes from an asylum.
Oh.
That woman is Patricia, whom Martin rescues on the road and marries shortly thereafter. Everyone in the film, from Henri to Martin to Patricia, is damaged somehow by their past. As the title suggests, Curse of the Fly is more about that legacy than literal monsters. And although there are some later in the film, there are no human fly hybrids present. Why would this is like a season of the Witch of the Fly series.
Yeah.
Curse of the Fly raises a number of interesting ideas, but leaves them ultimately unfulfilled. Low budget and lack of an actual fly monster probably dashed its chances. And the film was a box office dud. That's probably true of so many box office duds. Lack of an actual fly monster doomed Cutthroat Island.
Yeah, for sure. If there was a fly monster in there, that thing would have made hand over fist money. And I just love this idea that this woman escaped from a mental institution. This guy just picked her up on the road and then they got married.
It's a tale as old as time. Now, there was a movie I'd heard was good called Sator, but I didn't get around to watching it. You did.
I did, yeah. Sator came out in 2019. It was written and directed by Jordan Graham. The plot is there's an older woman with dementia who believes that she can communicate with an entity called Sator. And she does the writing. What's the writing where you scribble on paper and it...
Ghost writing. Automatic writing.
That's it. So she's doing that and she gets these crazy images. Her daughter's missing. That's kind of the setup of it. And her grandson, her adult grandson, is out in the middle of the woods looking for this thing, I think. Mm-hmm. It's beautifully shot. It's really atmospheric. The actors are really good. And when I started watching it, first 10 minutes, I'm like, ooh, wow, I'm onto something here. This is great. But as the movie went on, I lost interest because not much was going... It was all atmosphere and not really plot or action or anything was had. There was creepy bits, but by the time the creepy bits happened, I just didn't care what happened. From a visual standpoint and editing, I'm like, this is great, but I don't really care what happens to any of these people. I'm not invested in their relationships or what's going on or what they... I'm not even sure what they want. You and I were talking about before the show, it's important to know what a character wants, and then when those obstacles come up, that you empathize with them. Whereas I wasn't sure what these people wanted in it.
Right.
But it's gorgeous. It was shot in Santa Cruz and in Yosemite National Park. A lot of it takes place out in the woods. There's a lot of primitive animal skulls and furs and creature things out in the woods. And it's got creepy elements to it. It's got a really good mood, great sound. It's just I didn't feel anything.
Yeah, that's what you said. You said it was cool, but I felt nothing.
Yeah.
Rather than watch it myself, then I decided I really needed to catch up on something that everybody's been telling me to watch for years, which was Mandy.
All right.
We actually did an extra credit episode, I believe, or a bonus episode on The Color Out of Space, which was made by the same company. Mandy was the one that came before that. It's got Nicolas Cage in it, and it's made by Panos Cosmatos, who his father, George, famously made Tombstone.
Oh, wow.
So he's a Nepo baby. But, you know, I thought had an amazing style. And Mandy, it's funny, I mentioned this quote before, but I love that Office episode where Ellie Kemper's character is being forced by her boyfriend to watch horror movies and says, I really love the first half hour, you know, when the family's all happy and everything's going well. That's what she's getting out of the movies. But I have to say, for Mandy, that is exactly how I felt. It was such a beautiful first quarter. It's about a two-hour movie. So the first half an hour was just Mandy and Nicolas Cage's character in their house out in the woods, kind of being a couple. She's an artist that does like fantasy art. She would definitely be a listener of our show. She's reading like a fantasy paperback. All the fonts in the movie are all like old paperback fonts from the 80s. I think it's set in 86. And it's just so nice and sweet. It's the movie starts with this beautiful King Crimson song playing over the woods. He's a logger. By the way, I said when we did last month's Fire in the Sky, I was talking about how a chainsaw fight almost broke out. Well, that does happen in this movie. There is a chainsaw fight in the movie. So, yes, that is very pleasing. But anyway, to get to my point, by the halfway point, I don't know if you know anything about Mandy.
No,
but it's a revenge tale. You know, I thought maybe it would be like Straw Dogs or something like that. In a way, it is. There's a sense of humor about it. There's a cult that comes into the picture. Mm-hmm. And they are very funny. The way that they think, and the cult leader is a really hilarious character. Very good actor. And then there's some supernatural stuff in there, which I didn't expect to happen. It kind of was harkened back to Hellraiser. Mm-hmm. So all of that stuff was really interesting. But by the midpoint, the tragedies had happened. And then it becomes sort of about Nicolas Cage getting revenge. And I stopped really caring at that point.
Oh,
because I knew, you know, he'd get revenge. And he's just going to hurt a bunch of people.
Yeah. But like The Crow, I love that movie. There's something about it that I liked. As in, I know it's a revenge film. I know all these bad people are just going to get their comeuppance. But there was something in that particular film, maybe it was just the way it was done, that I was interested in.
Well, I don't have the answer to it, but that is exactly what it made me start thinking about. Why does a revenge tale work or not work? And I don't know. I think about The Count of Monte Cristo, which is sort of sets the template a little bit, is an OG superhero story in a way. And I loved that book. I love the way it unfolds, but it's an elaborate revenge tale. And it's very similar to these kinds of movies where about the first half, they just beat the shit out of this character.
Yeah.
I mean, to build the catharsis, you really have to punish the person so that they're angry enough and you feel with them, I want to destroy all of these people.
And it's justified.
And it's justified. You know, John Wick, they kill his dog and you're like, oh my God, I'm going to burn these people alive with John Wick. You know, I think maybe the difference is with The Count of Monte Cristo is that in that time he's in prison, he becomes the count. It's almost like training in a kung fu movie, you know? He learns all these languages and he gets smart about this and becomes more of a person. So it's not just, it's sort of like when Q shows James Bond all of the things the car can do. you go, well, he's going to kill a henchman with each one of those things, and I want to see that play out. So to get to see the Count of Monte Cristo as this new superhero-like entity exact that revenge is really thrilling. Whereas perhaps in Mandy, I knew he was a bad MF, but I didn't. There was no unveiling of powers or extra mystery maybe flowing into that second half so that it was just cruelty. And the Crow, is that in the Crow? I think so, maybe. You get to learn what his powers are or what the scope of what he can do is.
And maybe it's stylistically a little bit more interesting.
Oh, I don't know about that, though. I will say that, hey, it might sound like I'm beating up on Mandy, but it is stylistically amazing.
Oh, okay.
The sound design and the coloring, and I haven't really seen a movie that looks like it. So,
oh, wow. Okay.
It's worth watching just for that.
All right. Well, you know, I want to change gears a little bit about what I've been reading. I picked up a book. I got a story about this book because my father-in-law was telling me about this weird novel he read when he was a teenager that was a bit titillating, where there was women slaves that were nude all the time and had tails that were aliens. And I'm like, what are you talking about? What is this? So I put it out on Twitter. Because I was trying to figure out what the heck he was talking about or if this was just something from his fevered imagination.
Right.
But it turned out it's this book called The Lonnie People. And I found, you know, there's this used bookstore thing online. It's like World of Books, I think it's called here in the UK, where you can find old paperbacks for, you know, next to nothing. And I found an old copy, a beaten up, dog-eared, moldy-smelling copy of this. It's from 1962. The cover is very titillating. It has naked women. It's a painting of a group of naked women just kind of in different poses, and they have tails.
Interesting.
It's an interesting story because I'm not sure what's going on. The guy that wrote it was J.F. Bone, Jesse Franklin Bone. Real
name.
Is
that a real name?
That's his real name. I was like, that can't be. And it is. He was a veterinarian in real life, and the protagonist of the story is a veterinarian who falls in love with one of the Lani, these women with tails, in this future society. It's bizarre because it seems almost like it's feminist in ways, but then it's really sexist in other ways. It's surprising in its inconsistency. So I read the whole book, which is is nuts because I was just interested. It moves at a really good clip, and there's all this bizarre stuff. In the main character, the protagonist, the veterinarian that is hired, because the setup is that there's this intergalactic empire of humans, and they found a planet with these Lani on them, and they were enslaved like 200 years ago. So they've been under slavery for a long time, but they're really complacent. They're really docile. They don't fight. And they treat them relatively well. You know, they're having them do hard labor. They're doing like office jobs and stuff. Mm-hmm. And the sexual stuff is really downplayed. It doesn't seem like people are using them as sex slaves, but there's hints that everybody has had sex with them.
Right.
The protagonist, the veterinarian that's brought in about this, falls in love with one of them. And he uncovers, he basically finds out that there was a colony ship that had crashed thousands of years ago on the planet because it's distant future. And they are actually humans. They're descended from humans. They need to be free.
Descended from Lonnie Anderson, no doubt.
So
that's why they're the Lonnie people.
It's exactly
solved the mystery.
That's what it is. And
spoiled the ending.
It's really bizarre. And he's like a total Mary Sue, like the veterinarian.
Sure.
Can beat up like this, the tough Lonnie male comes in and he just rocks him, and it's like, what?
He learned his veterinarianism on the street
as a spacer. That was his excuse.
No, really.
I was a spacer for 20 years. You know, I did my, it's like, what? I thought you were a veterinarian. What's going on here? But
come on, that writes itself. He was a veterinarian and then he was in trouble in space, and the space mob was like, we need you to patch a guy up. And he goes, but I'm a vet. They're like, same skills. You know, stitching up space mobs.
It's a bizarre book. It's really weird. It feels like it wants to say stuff about, you know, slavery is wrong and oppressing people is wrong. And like, does that really need to be said? I don't know. It seems.
Well, it's in like science fiction. It's everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Questions of slavery. I think it's a shortcut to making people bad guys.
Right.
You know.
Well, that's sort of the weird, once the guy who's enslaved all of the Lani, I'm spoiling it, so if you're ever going to read it, it's revealed that they're actually human, he comes clean. He tries to fix the problem and like get them independent.
Oh, really?
So it was really weird.
Well, yeah, I guess it probably was trying to bring a civil rights message in or something
maybe,
like that.
I don't.
It's kind of weird that it's like the one weird thing is the tails, but then otherwise it's just sort of a.
They're totally normal people too. They have office jobs and they like, but they have no rights because they're not human.
Well, definitely then. That's just like one half of the face painted black and one half white on Star Trek, right? You just create some like key difference. Mm-hmm. and then look at the way people treat each other, which is always, yeah, that's a good theme to explore always. There's something to be reminded of.
I want to say it's not worth reading, but I read the whole thing. So, yeah, there's got to be something to it, because I don't read. If something's bad, I'm not into it. I stop reading it, and I've read the whole thing. In fact, towards the end, because I want to know what happened, I like stayed up late to finish it because I was tired, but I wanted to know how it ended.
Quite a tale.
So bizarre.
I'll take another left turn here. You know, there was a documentary that I watched recently, and I thought I'd maybe already mentioned it. Maybe I did, but it's called Class Action Park. Also from 2020, I'm a couple years behind on my movies because I knew a friend of a friend that made this one, but I really loved it. It's one of my favorite recent watches. It's about a theme park called Action Park that was in New Jersey late 70s through the 80s, where people just got hurt a lot. They designed this place very badly. The guy that set it up, it was a water park on one side. Mm-hmm. Then it had a huge bar and then like a racetrack where people could get go-karts up to like 50 miles an hour on the other side.
God.
And there was a freeway in between it. These attractions were designed not by engineers at all, just by whatever they could scrawl on a napkin and convince somebody to build. For example, like the first one that they built at the park was just a big tube that had a loop in it. No engineering went into this. What's going to happen to the kid when he flies through the loop? At first, they were putting crash test dummies and mannequins through there, and they were coming out all broken. They're like, well, we need to get a person in here. So they had some teenagers working for the park, and they were like, we'll give you $50 at the end if you go through that thing.
Whoa.
So all these kids were flying through it and getting really hurt. Some of the later teenagers that flew through, they had all these scratches on their arms and legs, and they couldn't figure out why. And when they busted it out open, it was because there were teeth embedded in the walls from the earlier teenagers that had come through.
God.
That were scratching them.
Oh,
yes.
My God.
To make a connection with Berenice. It's so funny and tragic, too, because some people died at this park. And to the documentary's credit, they let you laugh at it, but then they kind of touch bottom at a certain point and go, no, there were real consequences for this.
Wow.
But the park is incredibly dangerous. And it was sort of a badge to go to the park if you were a New Yorker or from New Jersey and come back with road rash and being all screwed up. And there's some really interesting interviews with other sort of Gen X people who went there. Like the comedian Chris Gethard. And he really susses out the theme of the movie, which is that latchkey life that we lived, that their parents didn't really care what they were doing. I mean, this place was, they just leave in the morning on their bikes and go to Action Park all day and come back bruised and beaten up, and it was fine. And how that was a really interesting life to have lived. It reminded me of the J.C.'s haunted houses we used to work in,
absolutely.
Which were so
dangerous.
Yeah.
So dangerous.
And he had an interesting line where he says, you get together with your friends at the bar and talk about how crazy that all was and laugh. And then you go to your therapist and talk about how crazy all that was and cry, you know, because there were two sides to that latchkey existence. You saw and experienced some things that you were a little too young to be seeing or experiencing.
Yeah.
So I really liked Class Action Park a lot. Mm. It's the whole package.
Speaking of being a teenager, I started watching Interview with the Vampire, the 2022 television series.
Right.
This is obviously based on the 1976 novel.
Yeah.
Anne Rice book. AMC did it. It's just come to the UK. It's on the BBC here for this month, Halloween. Mm. And they've changed stuff with it. And I love the changes. It's at New Orleans. Of course, that's like the regular book, but it's 1910. And Louis is black and he's a closeted gay man before he becomes a vampire. Whereas in the book, he's not gay, but being a vampire, sort of the thing is with vampires that they don't, gender isn't really as important and they don't really have sex, right? They do have sex.
No, I don't think they do, no.
No, they don't
actually
have sex.
But like, you know, Louis and Lestat sleep in a coffin face to face together, right? You know, I mean,
yeah, there was
they're
like
sort of pansexual.
But they explicitly state that Louis was a closeted gay man, black man in 1910 America, which is nuts. His business, instead of him being a slave owner, which he was in the book, he is a pimp. He controls a big part of the red light district of New Orleans. He's supplying his family with money, his mom and his sister and his brother. And they know he's getting it illicitly, but they used to be more genteel. They had like their father's business. His father ran a sugar production place. So they were legitimate, but he ran it into the ground. And then this is the way that Louis kept the family going. Super interesting stuff. Totally different from the book.
Yeah.
And Louis played by Jacob Anderson, who was on Game of Thrones. He was Grey Worm, the
Unsullied. Oh, right. That's where I know him from. Yeah. I haven't watched it yet, which is crazy that I haven't watched it yet, considering how much I loved those books.
Yeah, I didn't watch it. Well, it wasn't really available here. I was curious about it. It's florid. in that Anne Rice way, but there's so much new stuff going on with it, but it stays true to the original book that I'm super into it. I'm loving it.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to have to watch that.
I don't know if it's good, but it's hitting all of those. I feel like I'm a teenager again. I grabbed my Vampire the Masquerade book and started reading it last night after I watched it.
Oh, wow. It really got to you.
It got to me. It really got to me. I've only watched the first episode because that was just last night. But if the first episode is anything like the rest of the series, I'm sold.
Well, I'm sure it's better than, I think it's called Mayfair. Which is
Mayfair Witches, yeah.
The Mayfair Witches adaptation. Because I watched the first one of that and I loved it just because I actually really liked The Witching Hour, the book. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is fine with me. This is great. But it was still TV-esque. Yeah. I was mad that there weren't more episodes of it for me to watch. But so if I like that, I'll probably definitely like Interview with the Vampire. And I'm glad they did some new things with it because, you know, I think that's a really good film with Tom Cruise in it. So I don't need to see just that with younger actors. So
No.
It's There's great to...
More going on with it, and it's a lot more interesting, and I was really into it.
Other vampire news, the actress Laura Parker passed away recently, and she played Angelique on Dark Shadows, the original Shadows. Uh-huh. She's very charming. I really love that show. You know, we've talked plenty of times about how we both liked the 90s remake series that Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Ben Cross, but the original show I've only lately been watching, and it was because I found out that there were all these seasons before Barnabas Collins was on it, when it was still more of a film noir kind of Jane Eyre. And I put those on, and you can just let them play because there's so many. You know, there's 2,500 of these episodes or something.
Jesus.
And they're very repetitive. But there's something about it that it's this energy that you just don't get on television anymore, which is they didn't do retakes. You know, they didn't necessarily know their lines. A lot of those actors were drinking during the day. And it's all on camera. You know, like if the set falls over, they just keep going. They flub a line. They just roll with it. It's got this real madcap thrown together live energy that I actually find really charming, authentic. And I can understand why people are big Dark Shadows fans. Speaking of which, I watched this documentary Vampira in Me that was on Tubi about Vampira, the horror host, Mela Nurmi, who, passed away maybe 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, wow.
Is most famous for being in Plan 9 from Outer Space, where she doesn't speak and she just sort of creeps around the set. And it's kind of interesting how that was one day of work for her. I don't even know if it was a day. It was like an afternoon, one or 2 days. And it was just a job she took because her real job had gone away. And she didn't even really remember doing it. She had more interesting things happening that week. She went to Disney that week to be a model for Maleficent. They took a bunch of photos of her. And, you know, because she had that tiny little waist and she sort of created that goth look.
Yeah.
So it was a really interesting documentary because all of her shows that she did back then were live and broadcast and not recorded. Even at the station, they weren't recording the television that she was doing.
Right.
So we don't really get to see what she was actually like. But the clips that they do have, I mean, she created that whole horror host rap.
Sure.
You know, that you would later know Elvira for doing. Where she's doing the jokes. She's really funny and charming. She had been reading The Addams Family and decided that she wanted to try out a Morticia Addams look at a Halloween party. Mm-hmm. And they wound up putting her on local Los Angeles television to host these shows. So she created the whole character and the whole deal, which then syndicated all over the country with different horror hosts. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was a really amazing documentary. I recommend it. But as a writer, she's really interesting. Her mind is really fascinating. She existed on the bottom rung of Hollywood. That show was on for maybe 2 years and she was a phenomena. She was on all the late night talk shows and she would drive around in this hearse around Hollywood and people would get to see. She was like the proto Angeline. Right. It was really exciting to see Vampire and get your picture taken with her. And then after those shows got canceled, she was very poor. She at some point was working on an autobiography and she had this quote about being her opinion of Hollywood's fringe society. And I thought it was, man, it could be an opening paragraph for our show. And so I'm just going to play the clip. Listen to this.
Do you have any opinions on Hollywood's fringe society? Any opinions? Said I. That question and my answer to it. I see a fuming, bubbling mass of matter, rotating as it ferments. A myriad maggots burrow, slither, and writhe on its outer surfaces and in and about its subterranean passages. Slime-covered though we are, we cling still tenaciously to the undulating, sordid mass. for it is our world. The only world we neurotics know. Sometimes we find ourselves on its outer surfaces, where, if we pick the film of slime from our eyeballs, we can see the sun. Not feel it, of course, just see it. For we are unable to feel anything but the constant anxiety we know, which consumes us and never leaves us. Save rarely to make way for a frenzied, manic sort of hysteria. Sometimes we rationalize ourselves into thinking we have renewed our strength, having burrowed deep into... Okay? You don't want to know my opinions on that subject. All right.
It's too bad we didn't really get to know that side of Vampire, and that it's only her refusal to speak in the Ed Wood movie that we know. So I recommend checking that out. Anything else? We haven't talked about any RPGs. What are you playing?
Right now, I'm playing Dungeon Crawl Classics, which is like a Dungeons & Dragons retro-style game. Goodman cool. Games puts it out. Levi's running that.
Uh-huh.
Levi Nunez. One of the fun things about that game is you start off with this thing called the funnel. You make about 4 or 6 zero-level characters, and you go through a dungeon with them, and most of them are murdered. And whoever survives, that becomes your character.
That's great. Well, we did that. You ran that for us, but I think it was Mutant Crawl Classics.
I did, yes. Same game system, but different setting. Yeah.
But I really liked that because I had been to the Arboretum just a couple days before, and all of the plants sound like characters in fantasy games. So I had just taken photos of, you know, Virginia Creeper and Buttonbush and things right. like that. And that was the name of all my characters who all right. met a terrible end. We played that with Jamie Britton. It was really fun.
Oh, we did. Yeah. So that's fun. Steve Dempsey also plays that with with us. Steve, Levi, friend Jason Woodburn, and Rafe Ball. Those guys.
That's a good group.
Yeah. Lots of cool people.
Well, there's one person who's not cool, but I won't say who.
We all know. In person, I'm playing good old Everway, which came out in 94. It's a game I play tested back in 93 or maybe 92 with Jonathan Tweet and Greg Stoltze, because those guys are from the QC. So after college, and I went lived at the QC for about a year, I was play testing with John before he moved to Seattle to work for WotC, Wizards of the Coast. So I play tested the game, and they had a new 20th, 30th edition, anniversary edition of it. And I played that. We're playing that right now. And it's a fun game.
Comes full circle.
No dice. It uses cards to kind of solve things, to add a element of randomness to it. It's
credit cards. You just pay them to get things to go your way. Roll your skill. That'll cost you $5.
That's the way to do it. But yeah, there's a lot of cool game stuff going on. You and I are still working on our game.
We are. Still meaning that it's sporadic. You know, once in a while, actually get some time to write on it. But it is coming along, and we're hoping to have something sewed up by the end of the year, at least, for folks to look at. I think we achieved our goal, which is to cover everything, all of the movies, all of the topics.
Yeah, there's nothing else to talk about.
I don't think there really is, so we're going to let it go for now. Thanks, folks, for tuning into this Extra Credit episode, especially our patrons at the higher levels who make this possible. We love you guys. I just can't tell you how much we appreciate it.
You all are so amazing. Thank you. And with that, I'm Chris Lackey.
I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And you've been listening to
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.
Only on Patreon.
Strange Studies of Strange Stories.